Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 50, section 3, which is old single column, page 574. I think just to get ourselves back into where we were, I think I'll just reread that last paragraph of the previous section. As you may recall, it segues right into this section. So let's just kind of pick it up there. Remember, we're reading about the planetary princes, and we were working through some of the big picture issues up front here in these first couple sections. They were talking some about, you know, his celestial staff, and then we're going to get to the material staff here. So let me just read what they're saying there at the end. The controllers and transformers of planetary assignment are also able to collaborate with angels and other orders of celestial beings in rendering these latter personalities visible to mortal creatures. On special occasions, the seraphic helpers and even the Melchizedeks can and do make themselves visible to the inhabitants of the evolutionary worlds. The principal reason for bringing mortal ascenders from the system capital as a part of the staff of the planetary prince is to facilitate communication with the inhabitants of the realm. So remember, that's where we were. Melchizedek can turn that inner knob, whatever the heck it is, and make themselves manifest materially, but you get the impression that that's not a trivial thing, not as trivial as it is for a secondary midwayer to do that, because there's probably much greater morphing of nature. And you can have the master physical controllers do the whole routine where they put some kind of a material energy representation around the being to make them visible and tangible to us. But again, big rigmarole. So you want it to be very straightforward, to be able to have the planetary government be able to communicate with the with the mortals of the realm, not in a direct way, obviously per se, but to have that intermediary ability, so that you need some material individuals that can be the material hands and voice for that planetary government, and so they bring these individuals down from the system headquarters world, in Gerasim in our case. Okay, so that's what they're going to, they're going to give us initial little bit about the corporeal staff. Those who are familiar with the whole revelation know that there's a lot more about the corporeal staff in other places in the book. But let's see what they give us in this context here, this most general context, because remember, we're this is planetary princes in general. This is not just about our planetary prince. Okay, let's see what they say here.
Section 3, the prince's corporeal staff. On going to a young world, a planetary prince usually takes with him a group of volunteer ascending beings from the local system headquarters. These ascenders accompany the prince as advisors and helpers in the work of early race improvement. This corps of material helpers constitutes the connecting link between the prince and the world races. The Urantia prince, Caligastia, had a corps of 100 such helpers.
Okay, so a couple little things, even though they don't specify, you get the impression from that last sentence that it isn't always 100, apparently. We might suspect it's something in that ballpark. The one thing that might have caught you a little off guard there they're not just helpers for the prince, but advisors. Right? Remember, we talked a little bit about that last time, that the prince has available to him all manner of advisors, high and low. That little bit, should remind you that even though this Lenonadec son is downstepped very definitively to the point where it can be problematic, there's still a gap between their level of consciousness and ours. And they can use some experiential advice from someone who's been there and knows of that which they speak. I mean, a secondary Lenonadec does not know, of what he speaks when he's speaking about me, and living a mortal life. And so, you can see that it's the fact that they aren't just helpers. This, as they're saying, this connecting link, I mean, they really are on par with the planetary prince, in certain ways. Right? I mean, he's still definitely the planetary prince, but they're supposed to work in a reasonably collective fashion. Remember it. They were talking about how, it's largely autocratic. Remember how we read that last time? Okay, but even that, you notice it says largely, right? It doesn't say totally. Autocratic, right? So there is some government by committee going on. So keep that in mind. These individuals have a very profound role in in a world's evolution. In our case, those 100 individuals, we're going to have a very big say in how things rolled out on this planet, and even though there was a rebellion, that didn't change the fact that they had a big say about how things rolled out on this planet. When they went astray, lots of lemmings followed them, right? Because they wield some significant authority. All right, what else do we have here?
Such volunteer assistants are citizens of a system capital, and none of them have fused with their indwelling adjusters. The status of the adjusters of such volunteer servers remains as of the residential standing on the system headquarters, while these Marantia progressors temporarily revert to a former material state.
Okay, so just quickly there, since we're talking about that a lot here recently. I mean, you've got fur circlers, right? So very significant Marantia individuals that, for whatever reason, haven't achieved that last element of going from fur circler to fusion. So you can pull their adjuster out, and you need to, because they're going to function in a stationary fashion for a long time, right? Hundreds of thousands of years are going to function in a stationary mode. So they can't have, that grappling hook from paradise stuck inside of them wanting to pull them up as ascenders. Right? You got to pull that out so that they're not on the elevator up. And they can function in a horizontal mode for a long span of time. But we all know that therein lies a potential problem. Because they're advanced enough where if they have an adjuster, they're rebellion-proof, as we proved on Gerasim during the rebellion. They didn't need to be fused to not join the rebellion. But you take that adjuster out, and there's an Achilles heel then, where they can have a blind spot, and we discovered that blind spot very definitively on this planet. Okay, but I've said it many times. Just remember that's the, they can't use someone who's fused because the spiritual gravity is too much. They're just being pulled upward once very inexorably once you fuse with that adjuster. Okay, so, you know, it's an example of, well, there must, they must, you know, these poor people, they, you know, they must be, you know, retarded in some way, you know, they have infused, you know, I'm purposely using a strong word like that, right? You know, but look at, you know, who's first and who's last? You know, these individuals that have infused get this incredible opportunity that very few ascenders in the universe of universes get to function so intimately and definitively in the planetary government of a world for a long span of time. So, you know, as we always see, I mean, it's everything has its place, and everything, you know, in some sense is greater. Right, there really aren't any lessers in the whole. It's just when you look at some little thread that it seems like there's lessers and graders, but you look at it from another angle and it's the opposite, or, you know, or there is no difference between them, you know, in that regard or whatever. Okay, so keep that in mind. All right, in a little bit there.
The life carriers, the architects of form, provide such volunteers with new physical bodies, which they occupy for the periods of their planetary sojourn. These personality forms, while exempt from the ordinary diseases of the realms, are, like the early Maurantia bodies, subject to certain accidents of a mechanical nature.
Yeah, so they have to, you know, watch out for flying spears and things like that. Okay. You know, one of the things that, you know, to reflect on there is exactly what's going on. I mean, how do the life carriers implement this? And, you know, they give you this vague description. They provide such volunteers with physical bodies. Yeah, okay. Can you be a little more specific here? What do you mean? You know, but think about it. When you think about advancing up the psychic circles, or inward in the psychic circles, up those cosmic levels, in general, you know, as you're studying the adjuster papers, you know, you come to recognize that, you know, definitely when an individual is a first circler, that other self, that Maurantia self, you know, that up to that point, you know, you've just been completely oblivious to the existence of, that there's this other self making all these decisions and whatnot, going, you know, that there isn't just yourself, and then theoretically, you know, there's an adjuster self there, you know, but that third self, you have no clue experientially that other self is there. But when you get to be a third circler, you know, there can begin to be a very definitive back and forth, you know, a very definitive linkage between the adjutant self and that Maurantia self. And very much so, you know, with almost no qualification, Maurantia self, seated on that soul, you know, is seeing through and feeling through all of your material senses. I mean, it is to a degree even right now, even though you're completely unconscious of its existence. It's not so unconscious of your existence, right? Because it's got a, you know, it's looking at you from the top down. It's, you know, it knows you better than you do in many ways, right? You know, but at that, you know, at that point, you know, you've really eliminated, you know, the distinction effectively. And it's really like there is just one self instead of two, right? See, and that's what's going on here. Right? I mean, you've got these first circler individuals that, you know, are more than any first circler on a nativity sphere. I mean, they're first circlers that have gone all the way through the mansion worlds and made it to citizenship on their local system headquarters world. Okay, so a very definitive Maurantia self. And, you know, you just give it this adjutant self and body that it synchronizes with, you know, plugs into, and sees, feels, works through. And when you think about it in that mode, you know, thinking about your adjutant mindal self, you know, as that associating mechanism, between sort of the real personal you and the external world. You know, it's the associating mechanism, you know, or why they call them adjutants. You know, why do they call them helpers? You know, why do they call it helper mind, adjutant mind? Right? You can really see it here. Right? I mean, the real mind is that Marantxa mind, but then there's this helper mind, this mind that's an associating mechanism, a downstepping mechanism from that Marantxa self to the external material world on that planet. And so that, you know, the life carriers just, you know, give the individual that full body, like, you know, you could potentially have as a first circler, for that Marantxa self to work out to the external world through. Okay. You know, so you know, even though we don't understand all the physics of it, I mean, that's the basics of what's going on there. You know, it's as if kind of that you had an individual on that world that, you know, worked their way all the way up to first circler. Oh, only they don't have an adjuster. You know, you know, so it's again, it's that curious little thing. And that's another thing to remind yourself of. You know, if they weren't a first circler, there would be this disconnect. Because right now, if there's any definitive linkage between your adjutant self and that Marantxa self of yours, you know, it's via the conduit of the adjuster. But once you're up at first circler, you know, you can handle the linkage yourself. You really don't need the adjuster in such an, you know, fundamental way to be the bridge, you know, between the two selves, the conduit. Right. So you know, you're just up. You know, that you have an adjutant self that's up there at the level of that Marantxa self, and they just see eye to eye, as it were. And it works both ways. Now, like we've said many times, right now, your Marantxa self can sense spirit substance, spirit energy in the external world. You can't, right? You don't have any conscious awareness of what's coming in through those spiritual stimuli conduits, right? I mean, you have an awareness of what's coming in through your material stimuli conduits, right? I can see you, right? I can hear you, whatnot. But that Marantxa self, right, through you has access to the material energy in the external world, and via its own sensation recognition, you know, has an awareness of spirit substance in the external world.
Is it minded?
Yeah, it's a mindless self, yeah. Right? It's the real you.
You're just not conscious of it.
Right, you're just not conscious of it. It's complete. It's making all kinds of decisions. It's a total self. I mean, it's your higher nature copied. You know, it's the mindless self that's going to go on, not the one you know right that's thinking right now, right? And, you know, it's a full mindful self, you know, it thinks and feels and, you know, et cetera.
Grows.
Right, and it's being grown, yes, definitely.
As you grow, it grows.
Right, yeah. Right. You know, so, you know, when, you know, so it has access to both substances in the external world. You know, and so that's why when you have one of these corporeal staff members, right, I mean, they can see, you know, all of the basic lower-level spiritual phenomena in the external world, like, you know, the planetary prince standing there. And they can see all the material stuff, too.
Midwares.
Right, midwares, everyone, yeah, all the lower beings, right? Yeah, right. And that's why. It's not so much because somehow you've modified the sensory inputs of that adjutant self that they now are, you know, working in association with. They have that sensory ability themselves as a Marantxa self.
So if you were a first circular, could you?
Right, see, that's, as a first circler, right, there's a potential for you to pick up some of what the Morantia self is seeing, quote unquote, you know, feeling, sensing, and recognizing in its consciousness, you know, you could get handed some glimmer of that. And it's going to be tenuous, though, because like I was just stressing, there's a big difference between a first circler, like they were telling you, you know, on the mansion worlds, and a first circler on a nativity sphere.
Or a light and life sphere.
Right, or, you know, or an advanced sphere here too, right? But just, you know, but even on a light and life sphere, I mean, you know, there's still a differential. It's just less and less and less the more advanced that light and life world is. But remember how they kept stressing that on the when they were going through the mansion worlds, that, you know, here's effectively a third circler on the third mansion world, but, you know, remember it's a Morantia self, not an adjutant self, right? So it has an innate greater relationship with spirit energy than you can ever have, right, as an adjutant self. Okay. All right, so that's the basics of what's going on. So you've got these individuals that really have, you know, have a very balanced ability to relate to both substances in the external world instead of just the one like we can. You know, and that we've mentioned that a few times. One can really wonder, you know, if I could sense spirit substance, I mean, how many spirit structures or whatnot are there on this planet? There's got to be all kinds of spirit energy, spirit substance in the external world that I'm oblivious to. You know, where is it? What's it about? What would it be like if you could see that, feel that, whatever word you want to use? You know, and in some way, your Morantia self can. Right? You know, obviously as an embryonic Morantia self, it's gonna be very baby-like in its interpretation of that spiritual external world, but still. Let's see here. Is there anything else there? This bit about exempt from ordinary diseases, you know, it's like, remember they're a lot like an Adam and Eve that are on a nativity sphere, functioning, you know, a material son and daughter functioning as an Adam and Eve, that they're using the tree of life, and so they have all this additional stuff going on altering how subject to the vicissitudes of the material laws, you know, they are. But not when those vicissitudes get big enough, you know, like a boulder falling on your head. right? They're not immune to that. So, you know, they've got to be cautious about those sorts of things. Now you can, you know, think, well, what if something happened? Probably the life carriers jump in and, you know, because obviously if a boulder fell on them, it wouldn't squash their Morantia nature, yeah. Right? So, they can probably be fixed, even when very severe things happen. But still, they have to worry about issues. You know, they can get cut if they, you know, run through a briar patch or whatever. I mean, you know, they're not some sort of a Superman sort of a thing that, you know, isn't subject to those sorts of issues.
Chris?
Yep.
There is a difference in the structure of their brain. Is that correct?
Well, I mean,
sons and daughters.
We talked about material sons and daughters, about, you know, the actual Adam and Eve. Now you know that their children have to match up with,
right,
whatever the details are on the planet, like we talked about. You know, we don't really know. Again, it's just like at the Adam and Eve. We don't really know exactly what the deal is with these the actual prince's staff. As we'll see here in a minute, they're pointing out that there's a differential between the staff biologically and any offspring that they would have, just like there's a differential between the Adam and Eve and the offspring that they would have. So, you know, we really don't know, you know, like we were wondering, do you suppose all Adam and Eves are three-brainers, you know, and those sorts of things, you know, you can wonder about this a little bit. But you know, whatever, you know, in some way you know that they are exemplary, even if they aren't kind of radically, morphologically, you know, physiologically different, anatomically different or whatever in any radical way. They're going to be, you know, there's not going to be any genetic defects, right? Because the body is being built for them. So, you know, even if they aren't radically different from the stock on the planet, you know, in any gross way, right? I mean, the details are definitely different. I mean, they are archetype expressions, at the very least, of the, you know, the mortals on the world. You know, no recessive genes, you know, no, you know, negative recessive genes or anything like that, right? Okay, you got something? Yeah.
So, in the context of the Morantia self growing, Winston's wondering, mm-hmm. you know, how do we think about that in terms of our growth? Is that just all one growth? Is it a separate kind of growth where it's a spiritual growth going on with the Morantia self different from
I mean, you know, basically, right, I mean, as you are grown as an adjutant self, that greater adjutant self is copied, you know, into that Morantia self. Now, you know, as we were just describing, there is some differential in the experiences of the two selves. Right? So there is some growth that it's doing on its own, especially obviously the more mature that Morantia self becomes, the less it, you can think of it as just merely a copy, right? It's a copy with legs, as it were, right? You know, it can walk too, you know, and so again, subject to the limitations of how much walking that Morantia self can do on a, you know, in the few short years that it's living on a nativity sphere. But yeah, I mean, there will begin to be a growth differential, right, with time. I mean, and that's another reason why, obviously, this, you know, your initial life is just a short-term thing. I mean, because eventually that's going to become a boat anchor to the growth of that Morantia self, the real ascending self, right? And it just needs to be snipped off so that it can run freely, you know? It gets to the point when it wants to run, it can't because it's got this boat anchor attached to it, right? You know, but it can start to walk a little bit, or at least crawl, you know, on its own, you know? And in other words, be grown with some measure of independence relative to the differential of its experiences. Okay. Let's keep going here.
The prince's corporeal staff are usually removed from the planet in connection with the next adjudication at the time of the second sun's arrival on the sphere. Before leaving, they customarily assign their various duties to their mutual offspring and to certain superior native volunteers. On those worlds where these helpers of the prince have been permitted to mate with the superior groups of the native races, such offspring usually succeed them.
Okay, the next paragraph is going to get into this stuff a little bit more. But let's just note one little thing up front there. The prince's corporeal staff are usually removed. Yeah, let's just think about our example. Right, I mean, only Van and Amadon, and of course we're really just talking about Van here, you know, directly right now, was removed when Adam and Eve got here. Right, the rest of the loyal ones were removed, you know, when the Melchizedek receivers arrived 200,000 years ago. Right, so there's an example of where we are unusual. The usually didn't apply here. Yeah, so just if you've, you know, forgotten that little detail.
Were they removed or did they choose to go?
They were removed. They, you know, it was just, all right, time to go, pack up, you know. It's kind of like, the young kids of Adam and Eve, right? Yeah. You know, younger than 20.
To join the rebellion, they died.
Right, they became mortal because they got unplugged from, yeah.
What became of their Morantia selves?
Yes. See, this is a mystery, isn't it? Yeah, you know, not to mention, you know, we know that their adjusters are still waiting on Gerasim, if those Morantia selves have been bankrupted, if they're devoid of any meaning and value now, if they're empty, when the rebellion is adjudicated, there will be a resurrection of the unjust, quote unquote, relative to them. I mean, their adjusters won't plug into them again, and then that'll be the end of that. But you know, you've got to assume that someone has those Morantia forms in safekeeping somewhere, right? Because that Morantia's energy didn't dissolve when they died any more than your soul does. So
and they're being held for the adjudication.
Right. I mean, they would have gotten guardian angels, once they became mortals. Uh-huh. Right, and they don't ever really talk about that, but the normal routine would have been in play. It's just that it's unlike with Adam and Eve where they get unplugged and then they can get adjusters and go on. I mean, it's not like any of those rebels can get an adjuster. They already have an adjuster, right? And it's not allowed to plug back into them. So,
Phyllis says the majority of them have repented, and so some of them could have.
Well, they haven't. They're not alive. None of them have repented. Yeah, they just died, and they are in limbo land right now,
But it is important, I think, to realize that they are in a different than just mortal status, in the sense that if they had been just a mortal status, they would have arisen at the time of the dispensational resurrection.
Right.
Instead, they remain unconscious, waiting for the Ancients of Days to adjudicate the Lucifer.
Right, God. They're in cold storage somewhere. I mean, or whatever, how this works. You know, we've wondered about that a lot. But yeah.
It gives meaning to that old adage that I learned in the Marines. Never volunteer for anything.
No, you're going to have to volunteer for a lot of things on high. You're not going anywhere in your ascension career. You try to hide from volunteering. All right, let's get this another paragraph in here.
These assistants of the planetary prince seldom mate with world races, but they do always mate among themselves. Two classes of beings result from these unions, the primary type of midway creatures and certain high types of material beings who remain attached to the prince's staff after their parents have been removed from the planet at the time of their arrival of Adam and Eve. These children do not mate with the mortal races except in certain emergencies, and then only by direction of the planetary prince. In such an event, their children, the grandchildren of the corporeal staff, are in status as of the superior races of their day and generation. All the offspring of these semi-material assistants of the planetary prince are adjuster indwelt.
Right. So, just like the offspring of Adam and Eve are all adjuster indwelt, you see you have a quasi, in our case, 100-fold or 200-fold Adam and Eve situation. Going on with the prince's corporeal staff, where they at the very least, like they say, they always mate among themselves. You know, sometimes there's these additional things of them mating directly with the morals on the world, just like there's an exception every once in a while in Adam and Eve do, even, you know, without, you know, being a default situation, you know, messed up situation. You know, and like they're just pointing out, sometimes those children of the staff, you know, really do function like the violet race and made into the evolutionary races and contribute to the upstepping of those races. They don't talk about it here, but remember, it's a definitive upstepping that goes on because when they're connected to those energies that the Tree of Life allows them to be connected to, you know, that sustains them immortally, you know, that morphs their genetics to be more and more like the material son and daughter genetics of that local system as time goes on. So, you know, the more time that goes on, the more and more they really are like material sons and daughters there, you know, in great effect. Yep.
Talk about their mating. I thought that, you know, they weren't supposed to mate, and then they accidentally did this kind of quasi not sex move that caused them to create the first midwife.
Oh, okay. So before,
am I missing that point? Missing that? Or?
No. I mean, they say that they always mate among themselves in two different ways. Right? They always get their Marantxa energy systems to overlap and produce a super additive consequence of a primary midwayer, you know, so it's a Marantxa liaison that they achieve by engaging each other materially, but the point is not to materially procreate, it's to get the energy systems to overlap, you know, and so that reminds you that, you know, it might appear that when we procreate, it's a purely material thing, but it's not. Our mind, the mind energy system of the mother and the father are overlapping in that event too. It's not just a material commingling phenomenon, you know. And you see that very definitively when you sort of substantize that mindal phenomenon. You know, Marantxa is like mind made substance, kind of. You know, in the case of these individuals, you know, you see that substance super additive consequence literally produces this being, you know, as a literal expression of that super additive consequence. So, you know, keep that in mind about the two becoming one. You know, those are a mother and a father's mindal energy systems have overlapped in that procreative event, and it's, you know, it's another reason why that child until roughly age 16 is still, you know, connected mindily to those parents, right? Mindal conception, you know, so there's a separate mindal space for that child isn't until roughly age 16. You know, see, so that, and that's, you know, you can really understand that kind of mechanically or physically in that it wasn't just the two material things that came together at conception. It was the two mind energy systems that came together at conception too. Right? You're not just producing a blob of molecules when you're procreating. You're producing a child that has adjutant mind seated on that blob of molecules. You know, and you're transferring life animation to that blob of molecules. And I mean, this is a very complex phenomenon, you know, of the both phases of life animation, you know, mechanical mind, you know, initially with the single-celled conception, you know, the first adjutant, all those are being procreated as well in that child, not just the molecules, you know. And so that beyond the molecules part of the coming together, two as one, you know, is very definitive in these individuals.
You said there was two ways.
Though. Right, so there's that way, and then when the Adam and Eve are about to arrive, right, they're going to procreate materially, you know, and produce these material offspring. But sometime long before that, they, you know, they produce the primary midwares. Yeah.
One more.
Okay, yep.
So Winston's observing that this rebel staff became mortal.
Mm-hmm.
And but the secondary Lanonadec, tertiary Lanonadec, Abaddon and Caligastia, I mean, they didn't become mortal. And they're and so they're not dead.
No, they can't die.
He's just, you know, wondering how does that work? What's going on there? The same status as the other off planet.
Right. I mean, again, you know, the rebels that are still here, you know, the non-Midwayer angel rebels that weren't taken off at Pentecost. You know, we don't know how many or, you know, what flavors, but, you know, all the ones that weren't Midwayers or angels weren't, you know, were left here. Right? I mean, none of them are mortal creatures. They're, innately immortal creatures. So they, you know, there is no such thing as death for an immortal creature. Right? So the only way they're not going to be here anymore is if a divine executioner gets the word to, you know, to put their energy body back into the raw materials bin, right? Yeah.
Recycle.
Yep. Yep.
Who's on the prison world? I know Lucifer.
Well, from here, the only ones from here, you know, are the rebel angels and rebel midwares. Right? They're on the prison world now. You know, and then the rest, you know, all the ones on Gerasim and, you know, whatnot that went into rebellion are on the prison world.
Okay.
You know, finally at the beginning of the 20th century, Satan was rounded up and put right. there, right?
And other planets.
Right. Yeah, right. I mean, you get the other rebel worlds too, right? And, you know, one assumes that there's, you know, probably some that have been taken off those. But again, you know, I mean, think about the only reason that they were taken off here is because, you know, we had a paradise sun, right? I mean, you know, think about the neighboring planet.
Yeah,
they have rebellion and default, right? They haven't had a paradise sun, you know, magisterial sun, come there even on a magisterial sun mission yet. That's, remember, at the end of that paper, they're really, really hoping that it's not too much longer before the magisterial sun arrives. And there's a reason why. Because all those rebels are still on that planet. Think about those, you know, what fun the rebel midwayers are having on those benighted continents on the neighboring planet.
Yeah.
Fun stuff.
Yeah. Unchecked. Right?
You know, think about how those rebel midwayers could teach them how to build nuclear weapons and intercontinental ballistic missiles and,
yeah.
you know, to finally destroy that goody two-shoes island continent. Right? I mean, it's, you know that since they wrote that paper, you know, it's gotten very dicey on that neighboring planet, you know, because they are basically parallel with us in a lot of this technological development. You know, that island continent's not an island anymore, right? There's no walls big enough now. So you can suspect it's gotten very interesting on that planet. You know, and then on top of that, you know, the benighted continents having advanced technology to attack the good guys. The good guys were getting religion for the first time.
Yeah.
And so these tensions that have never been there before, you know, have erupted since they wrote that paper. And they're dealing with all kinds of zeal in their society like they've never had before. Religious zealots tearing them apart internally. You know, and the hordes attacking them externally. And they're going, that's why the revelators are thinking, boy, I hope that magisterial son gets here soon.
Yeah.
Hope it's soon. Right? They don't even have the spirit of truth, right? Right? Yeah. No universal bestowal thought adjusters.
Yeah.
Right? When they say benighted continents, boy, yeah, really benighted continents.
No wonder.
You know, Mad Max-like stuff, right?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So, all right, meanwhile,
one more
back to here.
Here.
Oh, is there another question?
Yeah,
okay.
Kermit asks, when do the midwayers receive thought adjusters?
Midwayers don't get thought adjusters and become ascenders until they're humanized, quote-unquote. You know, at some point, if they are, you know, taken off. I mean, they are modified so that they can receive an adjuster and become, you know, a little bit more like us, and then ascend with us. You can read about that in the Light and Life paper. You want to look that up. We'll get there in a while. Okay, let's see. The other stuff in this paragraph before we go on. Let's see. So we've got this whole issue of, you know, that sometimes, you know, that they're saying there at the end, the grandchildren of the corporeal staff, or there are grandchildren, I should say, of the corporeal staff. I mean, that those children actually, you know, mate with the evolutionary races, you know, and so those grandchildren, you know, become part of the evolutionary mix. And this sort of phenomenon of really kind of feeding the prince's staff very more definitively into the population at large, as opposed to just having some children of the staff to kind of take over mom and dad's jobs when mom and dad leave, you know, and still kind of just be part of the planetary headquarters phenomenon, but to really kind of just go out and be part of the masses on the planet. I want to just take a little aside here. You may want to turn to this because it's a little bit of a lengthy paragraph. It's in old single column, page 856, paper 77, section 2, paragraph 2. So paper 77, section 2, paragraph 2. I just want to read you that paragraph you may remember about what the life carriers had planned, kind of along the lines of what we were just reading, for our corporeal staff relative to feeding into the evolutionary stock. Okay, so if everyone is there, that paragraph that starts with the physical members. The physical members of the prince's staff had been constituted sex creatures for the purpose of participating in the plan of procreating offspring, embodying the combined qualities of their special order, united with those of the selected stock of the Andon tribes. And all of this was in anticipation of the subsequent appearance of Adam. So remember, we have this special race that you don't normally have, this quote-unquote pre-blended race with all of its interesting potentials, that Andonite stock. And the the life carriers wanted to work with that, you know, to upstep that pre-blended stock directly and then feed it in into the evolutionary stream. The life carriers had planned a new type of mortal, embracing the union of the conjoint offspring of the prince's staff with the first generation offspring of Adam and Eve. Right, see, so those children of the staff, rather than mating, you know, just directly with the evolutionary stocks like they were just talking about, they're going to mate them with the first generation Adamites. So, you know, these first generation staff descendants and the first generation Adam and Eve descendants, you know, so the purest expressions of those two sources are going to be brought together.
That was the plan.
They had thus projected a plan envisioning a new order of planetary creatures whom they hoped would become the teacher rulers of human society. So we were meant to have, you know, these kind of individuals, you know, helping us out. You know, they would be, you know, very wise, you know, individuals. Such beings were designed for social sovereignty, not civil sovereignty. So you were going to have this catalyst, you know, aside from, you know, from civil leadership. But since this project almost completely miscarried, we shall never know what an aristocracy of benign leadership and matchless culture your rancho was thus deprived of. for when the corporeal staff later reproduced, it was subsequent to the rebellion and after they had been deprived of their connection with the life currents of the system. And so you can see, once they're unplugged, when they procreate, their offspring aren't as upstepped as they would be normally. Right? We didn't get as high an offspring fed into the stock as we would have. One thing they don't explain there is these joint offspring of first generation Adamites and from the staff, would they just stay mating within themselves, forever? Or maybe just for a long span of time, and then blend into the evolutionary stock? But obviously at some point they would blend in. This bit we've just been reading up here, back to paper 50, you can see has a lot of immediate special relevance on our planet. We were going to have something like this, only kind of a decimal world variation on it, a special variation on it because of the special situation that we had here as a decimal world. All right. Let's see. Maybe just one last thing to stress, that fact that they say at the beginning of the back in paper 50 here, that paragraph we just read, these assistants to the planetary prince seldom mate with the world races, just like with Adam and Eve. It's going to be a seldom because there's bound to be a bit of a discontinuity in the genetics, and so there's probably would be issues. That's what you would be led to assume by the seldom thing. Maybe not as big a discontinuity like we had when our Adam and Eve directly mated. But very similar. So even that would be the main reason why it'd be seldom. You'd have to have some sort of a special circumstance where, maybe the offspring were so desperately needed for some emergency reason that you were willing to say sacrifice the evolutionary female who would die at childbirth for the sake of the offspring, or maybe you wouldn't do it that way. Maybe you would only do it taking a male of the and using the female of the upstep stock to prevent that from happening. You notice they mentioned the whole emergency things, so there could be some tough decisions that the planetary prince might have to make, and they might have to ask for some, I need a volunteer, right? just like in the military. All right, let's get this last paragraph in here.
At the end of the prince's dispensation, when the time comes for this reversion staff to be returned to the system headquarters for the resumption of the paradise career, these ascenders present themselves to the life carriers for the purpose of yielding up their material bodies. They enter the transition slumber and awaken, delivered from their mortal investment and clothed with Morantia forms, ready for seraphic transportation back to the system capital, where their detached adjusters await them. They are a whole dispensation behind their Gerasim class, but they have gained a unique and extraordinary experience, a rare chapter in the career of an ascending mortal.
We're kind of mentioning that up front, a rare chapter. Couple little things there. Remember again, I keep stressing this so that you don't forget. Notice how they made a point of saying Gerasim class. Remember that they aren't just streaming on to the system headquarters world as individuals, right? They're advanced in a very specific sized class, in our case, from the seventh mansion world to Gerasim. That's why there was such a relatively small number on Gerasim at the time of the rebellion. It's just that one class that's there. You know, they spend just that relatively small number spends a very short period of time relatively on Gerasim and off to the constellation they go. You know, as opposed to the large number that spends a long time on each of the Magian worlds, streaming up those one, you know, as individuals basically. Right. So they're just wanting you to not forget about that fact, that there was this very specifically chosen collection of individuals, a class of individuals. Just on, you know, they didn't just draw straws or whatever, you know, or name out of a hat, right? I mean, they're meant to be together for a reason, you know, and you've taken, you know, a subset out of that group, and they've gone off on this interesting adventure. Yep.
Do they ever catch up?
Well, I mean, you know. Yeah. If nothing else, but you know, when you're in the finality core, you've caught up, right?
Oh, yeah.
But and it's all going to depend on, you know, relative speeds. Of, you know, they may catch up with them on the constellation worlds because maybe the rest of their class, is kind of putzing along with all those difficult issues. But they got a bunch of experience in this thing, and they kind of they're a little bit precocious, and maybe they can run through all those worlds at the constellation level. A little bit faster and catch up with them. Who knows? You know, you can speculate.
They said they were in the same class, but I think they said before they really didn't, maybe one or two, but most of them didn't know each other.
Right.
So they may have been in the same class. It is big class.
Right. I mean, yeah, just remember, you know, you got all these, you know, all these worlds, you know, in our group of worlds, you know, roughly 200 or so worlds, you know, streaming onto the Magian worlds, and you know, there's just legions of ascending mortals in the seventh Magian world, and this little class is selected out, and you know, they've barely gotten to know each other, and this, you know, these 100 are snatched out, you know. So, all right. There was one other thing there too, wasn't there? Let's see. In the first part there about yielding up their material bodies. You know, so like we were saying, I mean, they can, the life carriers just put them into some sort of unraveler machine, you know, and you know, but their Morantia, you know, nature is intact, you know, and can be reconstituted the way it needs to be, whatever, you know. But you get the sense there that maybe, you know, they don't just take sort of the Morantia form that's on Gerasim and just completely as is plug it in. It sounds like maybe it's modified a little bit, so maybe it's a little more soul-like, quote unquote, or something. You know, it's a little, you know, who knows? But it sounds like there's some sort of a modification of that Morantia nature. But nonetheless, I mean, you know, you could do any sort of a dissembling process on that body, and their Morantia nature is unscathed. And you're left to just speculate how the life carriers, liberate them from their material bodies.
Quickly.
Right? I mean, they're put into sort of an unconscious state.
Well, they may use the same material thing they used on Jesus.
Well,
that was different.
Yeah. Anyway, you know, they never explain all this stuff about, you know, Adam and Eve being dematerialized and rematerialized, all that fancy physics stuff that they allude to there. Anyway, all right. So that's the little thumbnail of the staff. Now we're going to get a little thumbnail of what they're up to. And again, you know, remember, there's a lot about what the prince's staff are up to in terms of teaching the mortals. Up in the paper about the prince, our prince. But here they give a little thumbnail of it in general here.
Section 4, the planetary headquarters and schools. The prince's corporeal staff early organized the planetary schools of training and culture, wherein the cream of the evolutionary races are instructed and then sent forth to teach these better ways to their people. These schools of the prince are located at the material headquarters of the planet.
Yeah, that little issue is a bit like that management, size management we were just talking about with the classes going to Gerasim. You take a very manageable little group of the mortals on the world and you bring them into the planetary headquarters and upstep them, educate them, and send them out. You don't just open the gates and the walls and let, you know, the hordes just come in and, right. I mean, you know, there's a lot of chaos outside of the walls of the planetary headquarters, you know, and you need to very carefully manage this. You know, just like with Adam and Eve, you know, the very first things you got to do is build a wall, right? right? There's no illusions about, you know, well, if we just speak to them nicely, you know, we'll be, okay, no, you build a really big wall, several of them, you put lots of carnivores between them to eat the people if they try to get in, and, right, I mean, they're serious about walls,
yeah.
You know, when you're putting yourself in the midst of a very lowly group of mortals. But you find a cream, bring them in, you know, into your side of the wall, you educate them, and then you put them back out the outside of the wall and tell them to go to it. What we're just about to read about that. Yeah. And for those of you on the webinar, he's saying, wouldn't they just have like shields, you know, like in, you know, a science fiction show? They're just about to mention that, those sorts of issues here. Let's see, I think that was all there, right? Yeah, keep going.
Much of the physical work connected with the establishment of this headquarters city is performed by the corporeal staff. Such headquarters cities or settlements of the early times of the planetary prince are very different from what a Urantia mortal might imagine. They are, in comparison with later ages, simple, being characterized by mineral embellishment and by relatively advanced material construction. And all of this stands in contrast with the Adamic regime, centering around a garden headquarters, from which their work in behalf of the races is prosecuted during the second dispensation of the universe suns.
Okay, a few elements there. Let's take that one we were just talking about. Very different from what a Urantia mortal might imagine. Mm-hmm. Right? What are they talking about there? Okay, there aren't going to be force fields. Why not? Okay, you know, and why not? You know, what someone saw in a vision on Gerasim, you know, one time. Why doesn't the planetary headquarters look like that? Okay, because all of these individuals that come to a world are evolutional in their engagement, not revolutional. Right? Because if they were revolutionaries, you know, if they had revolutionary building design,
we know what happens.
That would be rebellion. Right? Right? I mean, the fifth epical revelation, you know, is not revolutional, it's evolutional. It's designed to meet us where we are, as we are, you know, in as organic a way as possible. However, you know, you take where they are and you show them the best that you can do kind of in that mode, right? Just like an exceptional mortal might do the same sort of a thing. Right, so, you know, when they talk about being characterized by mineral embellishment and by relatively advanced material construction, okay, you know, relative to the world as it is. And, of course, that planetary headquarters would get more and more sophisticated as time went on. By the time the world is settled in light and life, the planetary headquarters is not going to be built out of, you know, sort of roughly hewn stones. It's going to be really cool.
Well, as I recall, which is sketchy, the headquarters of the planetary prince, these were brick buildings. There was no stone.
And there's a stone temple of the father.
But
right, and there's, you know, but it's, yeah, basically,
but
just
it was basically you're teaching.
All right, you're just picking up where they are, showing them what they can do, kind of with the level of sophistication of technology that they have, right? And you just go along with them. Now, why do they bring in the contrast? And all of this stands in contrast with the Adamic regime centering around a garden headquarters. You know, okay, so a garden in contrast to mineral embellishment, you know, material construction. We're going to get to it very directly here in just a little bit. Remember why the prince and his staff come. They're an uplifter of a certain kind. What kind? And what kind of an uplifter are they? They're not a biologic uplifter like Adam and Eve, or an intellectual uplifter like a magisterial son, or a spiritual uplifter like a bestowal son. They're a civilizational uplifter. Right? There's a certain, and of course when they first come, very, very primitive, quote-unquote civilization, right, in place, that they come to uplift. Right? Just meet it where it is. Right, they're civilizational uplifters. So they're giving them examples of civilizational expression in their building design and stuff. Whereas Adam and Eve, no, they're not doing that. They have this garden. So now think about the fact that on this planet, we really don't have any memory that there was this sort of example of better technology on the planet at one time, the planetary headquarters, as well as an example of an idyllic garden. All we really remember is that there was an idyllic garden. And this feeds into this bias that we have. The more spiritual consciousness we have, the more biased we get about this. Technology bad, gardens good. Back to nature, quote unquote. The good old days are back to the garden.
Be careful now, you're living in Boulder.
Yeah, I am. We're working on paper 68 in Symmetry of Soul, talking about this very issue, right? Challenging, you may remember what the revelators say about back to nature in paper 68, right? They're very direct about it. They don't use nice words.
But they don't do the same back to nature, I think.
Kind words.
Yeah. And there's a when you read that, it's kind of, it's not all inclusive of what I think you're.
Anyway,
there's some truth in the back to nature.
We don't want to go too far afield, but there, you got to remember that there's a lot of falseness that we have on this planet because. You know, we've got this bias against technology because we didn't have these individuals that were really trying to show us technology and holding it up as a positive thing. And we've come to treat it in a very negative way.
You think so? Why do we walk around with a cell phone?
And, we're still material beings as everyone walks around with a cell phone. But, you know, if someone is very idealistic, do they love, all things industrial, right? You know, those sorts of things. The funny thing is that they claim to be this hyper non-materialistic, idealistic person, you know, and they can't pull, you can't pry the cell phone out of their hand, you know, right? That's the little thing you can notice, that maybe they aren't as spiritual as they think they are. All right, but nonetheless, they're trying to, their thought of idyllic is not, this material construction place back in the days of yore. Their ideal of idyllic is that garden back in the days of yore. Well, that's not a very far back. Much farther back, much more foundational, is the planetary headquarters. If you want to go back to the foundation, that's what you should be going back to, not the garden. And then on this planet, it's even more so. Because unlike a normal world, we weren't supposed to have a garden for any length of time. So it's even more false to think of going back to the garden here. We weren't supposed to be, they purposely built a garden in a place that in a very short time would sink and be gone. So this planet wouldn't have a garden. We are supposed to be a planet that goes out from the garden. You know, and so all the more on this planet, to think that where you're supposed to be is back in the garden is all the more false.
Though they do say, even in highly evolved worlds, that working with the soil is one of the most...
Right. It's one thing to work with the soil. It's another thing to just sit there static, staring at your belly button in a garden. A Garden of Eden, right? You're not out in the fields, still in the soil. That's, you know, it's a different thing. Okay. So not to belabor that, but just, you know, notice that that's what they're bringing in, the contrast. You know, the biologic uplifters are very much, you know, in tune with the material thing. That's why they're in a garden. It's just to, you know, to point out that they're at that very material biologic level in what they're doing, you know, sort of very natural. You know, they're going to mate with you. That's all very natural. Whereas, you know, the prince and his staff are there not to, in general, you know, just become part of the evolutionary phenomenon, but to stand apart, like we just read in the first paragraph. You know, you come in, you get uplifted, and then you go back out. Okay.
Much of the physical work connected with this... I already read that.
Yeah.
In the headquarters settlement on your world, every human habitation was provided with abundance of land. Although the remote tribes continued in hunting and food foraging, the students and teachers in the prince's schools were all agriculturalists and horticulturalists. The time was about equally divided between the following pursuits.
Okay, before you go on, just, you know, see, notice there, we were just talking about the agriculture. And, right, okay, so on our world, apparently, exceptionally, human habitation was provided with abundance of land. So yes, you know, farmers and, you know, and gardeners, you know, agriculturalists and horticulturalists, but it's like I said, it's the you know, a lot of the Garden of Eden is not about food production, right? It's about just being this idyllic place that you just go to stroll through. And, they aren't farming in the northern hemisphere of Edentia, right? That's just a place, you know, the garden hemisphere of Edentia is where you just go to commune with the natural world, right? You don't go to the labor. Okay, so, you know, and that could produce problems with salubriousness, you know, and getting too place-like, not, you know, not having enough of a prodding to be direction-like.
Is that any different than sitting in front of your computer all day long?
No, it's not, right? Not, a, you know, effectively, but like I said, few things are as exalted in our lore as the garden, right? Okay, so you've got this time being about equally divided between these following pursuits.
One, physical labor, cultivation of the soil associated with home building and embellishment. Two, social activities, play, performances, and cultural social groupings. Three, educational application, individual instruction in connection with family group teaching, supplemented by specialized class training. Four, vocational training, schools of marriage and homemaking, the schools of art and craft training, and the classes for the training of teachers, secular, cultural, and religious. Five, spiritual culture, the teacher brotherhood, the enlightenment of childhood and youth groups, and the training of adopted native children as missionaries to their people.
Okay, so we'll look at some of the details a bit here. Notice the pattern of the order you know, as they're sweeping from the individuality endpoint in number one to the unity endpoint in number five, with various flavors of associativity in between, you know, intellectual, social, you know, associativity expressions there. Yeah?
So when you read this sitting here today, you know, you can sort of, you know, equate it to life in the 20th century, you know, these things. But when you think about this, as you pointed out a minute ago, on most normal worlds, the planetary prince comes, you know, considerably earlier than they did on this particular world even. And so they're dealing with people that are really in the, you know, just out of the animal stage of life, correct? And to be able to do this, it has to be done at their level as they begin, correct?
Right, but again, on for those of you in the webinar, he's saying about the difference about when the prince normally comes relative here. You know, on a normal world, they come shortly after you have the first will creatures, but remember, the first will creatures are sangic.
Right?
They are civilizable. Andonites are not civilizable very fundamentally. Right? The civilizational uplifter can't come to those who aren't really civilizable. Remember, Andonites nearly couldn't consciousize the notion of grandchildren. Right? I mean, they're a very limited sort of a mentality. Right, so they had to wait until they were sangics.
But even at that point, they were still pretty primitive.
Sure, they're very primitive.
So when you read these, you can also, you know, somewhat equate them even to today, sort of things. But the level of which they accomplish these in a primitive culture has got to be quite creative or intelligent. And, you know, as you said, mm-hmm. So they don't overstep it.
Right. So that's what I was just about to get to. The specifics of, say, the physical labor, you know, back 500,000 years ago, or the vocational training back 500,000 years ago. Okay, the facts of that are not, you know, very significant or relevant. Like you're saying, they're very much attuned to that very primitive state back then. And it's not something that you, well, let's just figure out what it was and let's do that. I mean, that's what religionists always like to do, is take some very primitive thing and try to eternalize it. You know, our ancestors 100,000 years ago believed this, and so we should believe it now. You know, we should believe in sin, sacrifice, and atonement now, right, or whatever, right? So you want to avoid that. You want to look not at the facts, the truth. And so that's what I was trying to get at. You know, what's the initial pattern that you're seeing there is that there's a spectrum. They purposely laid them out on a spectrum from individuality through various phases of associativity to unity. So in other words, regardless of the details, if you want a complete educational, you know, or mentoring, influential regimen, it needs to have that full spectrum of character to it, right? You can't be just fixated on the spiritual culture, you know, or the physical labor. It needs to be balanced. There needs to be an equity amongst all that. Amongst the various aspects of the threefold actuality. So you've got, they're trying to encourage a full threefold actuality because they'd like them to begin to develop a personality manifestation that'll encompass that threefold actuality. Well, that sounds kind of good in itself, but more directly, why would they want them to do that? Because they're civilizational uplifters. And civilization, there's nothing biologic about civilization. Something biologic about society or even culture, but not civilization. Civilization is a choice. Civilization is a manifestation of personal expression. Personalized selves can be civilized. So they're trying to encourage more personalized selves. And the only way to do that is to not just give them the unity part, or the individuality part, but to give them the full threefold so that they can encompass it and begin to have a triunity nature, you know, that can express in collective fashion as a civilization. You know, that's the key thing. Even in, you know, look at that vocational training, You know, so you got things like, okay, schools of marriage and homemaking and schools of art and craft training. Okay, but then when they throw in, and the classes for the training of teachers, secular, cultural, and religious. Again, right? The threefold, right? The things that have to do with individuality, the secular. The things that have to do with unity, the religious. And what's in between? And they purposely didn't say societal, they said cultural there, to remind you that you are definitely feeding in the unity character from the religious end into that sort of basal associative expression that is societal or society. You know, and in a simple developmental sense, you have society stemming from the fact that you have a fifth adjutant, a social impulse. You juice that up, you bring some cult into, you bring some religion, or some religious impulse into that society, and amp that society up as a culture. Right? And then you're trying to take it the next step. To begin to have some rudimentary response to the philosophic impulse and some actual personalized self-consciousness so that you can have a civilization. What else? I mean, you can kind of just reflect on the details there. I mean, that you've got, group teaching, starting with the family, as well as more individualized, where you put individuals into a class, take them out of their natural social unit of the family, so you can see how they have both sides there. You have some thoughts you have?
Yeah, I'm thinking how we pass on civilization and culture today.
Yeah, or don't.
Yeah. Well, we do after a fashion, but we're not direct about it.
Yeah.
We don't really think through why we're doing it and what's the best way. It's just kind of pretty happenstance.
Right.
Here, it's directed, and even though the people are primitive, this headquarters here, I mean, this is consistent. Year after year, generation after generation, it's there. It's always there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and see, again, you're getting at, we have a civilizational emergency. That's why this book is in my lap, right? Because it's sad to record that there's almost no reflective thinking going on into something like what is civilization, and how can you pass civilization on to the next generation? Obviously, you're not going to pass it on in any sort of definitive way if you don't even know what it is. And then on top of that, if you don't know the difference between society, culture, and civilization, how do you, how are you going to pass on that subtlety of differential to the next generation? And then on top of that, you've got a lot of so-called spiritually conscious individuals, people who are very motivated, animated by some initial recognition of ideals, who turn around, and declare that civilization is a word that should be outlawed, that it's a word that's been created by as a word of suppression, of subjugation. I'm civilized and you're not. And the extent that they see someone do that, they think, well, the problem is not the individual who's falsely wielding the notion of civilization as a club like that, but that civilization is innately evil and should be rejected. We should go back to what's natural. Civilization is obviously artificial. Yes, it is. It's an art form. It's about personal management. The world is a world that's enlightened life is not natural. You finally get to light and life because it's purely artificial, finally. It's fully personally managed. It is a worldwide definitive civilization. choice is not natural. You know, even that Maharaja self we were talking about can't choose. Right? It has no personality identified with it. It can make decisions, but it can't choose. You know, and so even though your lowly adjutant self is just that lowly relative to that Maharaja self, you have something that it doesn't have. You have the power of choice.
How can you make a decision without choosing?
You can make all kinds of decisions without bringing eternity into play. Choice is bringing eternity into play. Decisions are about time. Right? I mean, I can decide to move that cup like that. Is that because I have some concept of how that's related to eternity? No, I have no choice thing going on there. I'm just making a decision to move the cup. So
you made a decision to use that as an example. You didn't choose to use that.
No, I didn't. I'm not doing any choice thing right now. I'm living off of, I hope, in an overarching way, some choices I've made. I mean, obviously, if you make a choice, you don't have to remake it, because a choice is not relative to time. It's relative to eternity. So it spans all time, right? It's innately functions at every moment in time. You know, that's an easy way you can think about it. Did I make a choice or a decision? It's like, well, if what you did was a choice, it's independent of time.
An example of a choice?
I take the simplest one that everyone can understand who knows the Bible. Choose this day whom you will serve. As for me, I will serve the Lord. That's not a decision, that's a choice. Right? You're not saying, well, right now, in this room, for 5 minutes, I'll serve the Lord. But, you know, not tomorrow. I mean, everyone knows that's, you know, the spirit of that sentence is, you're just going to serve the Lord, period. In every place, at every time. You're never going to have to come back to that. That's just that's the drone tone in the song that you're going to play from then on. It's the foundation upon which all your decisions rest. That's a choice. You've chosen to be part of eternity, where the Lord is. Whereas if I choose this day to serve myself, you know, think about that problem. It's like, well, did you really choose? Maybe you just made a decision to serve yourself. Yes, but I could turn this power of choice around. Right? I can create a false eternity, bubbled off from the real eternity. If I'm completely successful in that, I've reached what's called iniquity. Right? I'm part of eternity now, the nothing part. Rather than the something part. Right? With every measure of creativity comes an equal measure of destructivity. Right? Yep.
Self-mastery would be a choice with a lot of decisions involved.
Right. You make an upfront choice that you're going to be constantly seeking to supply the favorable conditions to be grown into a mastered self. Choices are, you know, as a technical fact, are sparse. You know, they're few and far between, and they're very potent. It seems like a simple little thing to just make a choice, but it has eternal consequences. You know, that inability to distinguish between decision and choice is why 4,000 years ago, when Melchizedek told them that faith alone, they go, no, that doesn't make any sense. It's like, no, you don't understand. You think you're just making some sort of decision, and it's got to be more than some little decision. I'm asking you to make a choice. And that's everything. That's not a little something. That's everything. Choose to identify with eternity, and then you're done. And transcend decisions, transcend time.
Thank you.
Okay. So just maybe one other little thing. You know, when they get to the unity end there, you can see kind of some of the relativity that you were talking about the time, you know, that the planetary prince's staff is working. So spiritual culture thinking, ooh, what's this going to be? And then the teacher brotherhood. I mean, like the teacher's lounge, or, you know, the enlightenment of childhood and youth groups. Okay, what are we getting at there? That's why I said, you know, up front you want to notice that you've got individuality, associativity, unity. So when they say spiritual culture, they mean bringing unity more definitively into play. You have the teachers. They're individuals. If you put those teachers in the context of some initial sheet of unity, if you will, you know, an initial continuum of unity, there's an advanced associativity there. They aren't just, you know, a group of teachers. That's why they chose the word they did. They're a brotherhood. The word hood is reminding you of the greater unity there. They predicate their teaching more on a unity foundation than an individuality foundation. To turn it around like that, you know, the enlightenment of childhood and youth groups. I mean, what are they fundamentally talking about there? I mean, think of the hourglass analogy, the mindful self. Right? The spiritualized mind is in the upper domain of the hourglass. Right? To take, you know, childhood and youth groups circumstances, and as adults, as teachers, as mentors, to structure those in such a way that it fosters them utilizing the upper domain, you know, the hourglass of their mind, to actually use the personalized self to bring some objectivity into those simple child and, you know, youthful associations, those phenomena, to bring some unity into the individuality of those circumstances. You know, so it's all very subtle things, you know, and obviously it's going to take, you know, if you think about, well, what if I got this job? How would I do that? Well, you're going to need some training. You're going to need some skill, some wisdom about how you can subtly do this sort of stuff. You know, and just that training of adopted native children, right? There's not much unity out there outside the walls. You bring them in and you immerse them, you know, in this environment where naturally there's a coordinating influence that's just not normally there. And they go out just naturally using the part of their mind that can coordinate with the universal harmony. They predicate their thinking more on that foundation rather than the material foundation. Okay. So that's, you know, like I said, I mean, the word culture in contrast to society there is already reminding you of this being more the more spiritual aspect of that society. And so they're just, see, sort of emphasizing that, you know, that how it is that you get that spirit into that society so that that society is a culture.
That kind of when Jesus was saying, you know, by the extent to which you have to go out is, you know, the measurement of, you know, to go out after people.
Oh, yeah.
It's not as good as if they come to you because you're living, because you're being the person. You know where I'm at.
Yeah. I know. Yeah, and for those in the webinar, he's bringing up this whole bit about Jesus about, you know, it's not about going out but drawing them in. Right, I mean, so you can see that the planetary headquarters becomes a little nucleus of spirit gravity, as it were. Right, the unity that's there, like I said, that's not out there. By grace, we all will be attracted to that. Right, those who have the capacity, see, and so those individuals will be drawn towards that light. The center of the planet. Those who don't have the capacity won't be. You know, so, but you'll draw those in, and you'll foster that potential that they demonstrated by being attracted to that that place of light. You know, and then you'll send them out again. All right. So anyway, so that's the idea. What else do they say here?
A planetary prince is not visible to mortal beings. It is a test of faith to believe the representations of the semi-material beings of his staff. But these schools of culture and training are well adapted to the needs of each planet, and there soon develops a keen and laudatory rivalry among the races of men in their efforts to gain entrance to these various institutions of learning.
And why is it keen? Okay, because any even the littlest bit of unity spirit is seductive. You're drawn to it, right? They all get intrigued by this. You know, we're intrigued by that by design. Oh, that's cool. I'm interested in that. So they all, I want to pull myself up by the bootstraps enough that I might be chosen, you know, to go inside the walls. So it fosters that, you know, a very important initial stimulus of competition, you know, if nothing else, just within yourself. Competition between your better self and your lazy, lesser self, right? To pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Note this test of faith. I'll come back to that in a minute. You know, going, well, I don't understand. A test of faith? And what does this have to do with God? Okay, it is a good spot to think about that, that one of those little definitions of the word faith that you can use. Personal recognition. You've got these representations from the staff of the planetary prince. And you're calling upon individuals, it's a test of faith, to have the subtlety of recognition that they can see via that representation that there indeed must be a person behind that representation. That it's that these the corporeal staff isn't just pretending that there's someone behind them that they can't that the mortals can't see. The way the staff, the corporeal staff, manifest themselves, you can get the subtle sense that there's a reality, and more than that, a personal reality that they are, that is shining through them. Okay? That personal recognition, that faith grasp, so it's an initial attempt to exercise that. So again, look at the awesome responsibility. Look at the trust that's placed in the prince's staff, the corporeal staff, that they have to conduct themselves in such cosmic, with such cosmic quality,
integrity.
And such integrity that an unseen person can basically be seen through them. I mean, you know another person that did that, right? Yeah, he was seeing me and seeing the Father, right? For Jesus to conduct himself, you know, and with such integrity that through him you could get a personal recognition of the unseen individual that he's representing. Now, of course, it's even more remote than that, as we know. Technically, he's not directly manifesting the will of the Father. He's manifesting the will of the First Master Spirit, you know, and manifesting the will of the First Master Spirit is sort of the Father is behind that, right? You know, so it's even more indirect, but nonetheless. So that the prince's staff, I mean, these guys that seemed to be a little retarded and hadn't fused yet, look at the job that they're given, right? Now, of course, if that personal unseen being begins to be destructivity instead of creativity, they will just as definitively manifest that personal expression too. Okay, because they've got themselves attuned to whatever that personal, you know, expression is. It's going to feed through them. They're going to represent it.
Huge responsibility.
Right? So not just the decisions of the planetary prince, but the choices of the planetary prince are going to come through them. Okay, what else we got here?
From such a world center of culture and achievement, there gradually radiates to all peoples an uplifting and civilizing influence, which slowly and certainly transforms the evolutionary races. Meantime, the educated and spiritualized children of the surrounding peoples who have been adopted and trained in the prince's schools are returning to their native groups and, to the best of their ability, are there establishing new and potent centers of learning and culture, which they carry on according to the plan of the prince's schools.
Okay, see, so there they, you know, there's those adopted native children as they just mentioned in item number 5. And right here it is, see, in direct black and white. What kind of uplifters? If you don't put it together through synthesis, how about finding it by analysis? Here's the sentence that says it directly. There gradually radiates to all peoples an uplifting and civilizing influence, right? The civilizational uplifters, that's the prince's staff. They are the civilizational uplifters. Let's see, you know, and all of this, like I was just saying, you know, is very, very important, you know, because the emergency that put this book in my lap is a civilizational emergency, right?
You said it was philosophical.
Well, yeah, and that's and you don't have a civilization until you begin to have a philosophic quality in play. Right? Yeah, we'll see that in the next section here. You know, we get to next week. Now state that directly.
There's a great danger now, but it's also there's great potential, because until recently we didn't really have a science.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we now have science and religion. Neither is very true, but we at least have them both in play in a more equal, equal way. Before, science was so retarded compared to people's religious consciousness that there
couldn't be a super additive consequence.
Couldn't
yes.
be a balanced super additive consequence.
Right. Yeah. We are ripe with potential, but you know, all potential can be expressed in two different ways, right? Creativity or destructivity. You know, you can be quivering on the very brink of the positive side or the negative side. You know, and what you're quivering on the very brink on is a bigger thing than ever before. And the bigger they are, the harder they fall. Right? If it goes to the negative side, you know, the interregnum is greater now. Right? The greater the potential for a positive world order, you know, the more negative the interregnum potentially could be if you don't properly take a hold of the potential, wield it in the opposite direction. So civilizational uplifters, you know, and notice it's a culture and achievement there gradually radiates, not suddenly, gradually, right? It's all very evolutional. Now there are suddenlies in evolution, but the staff just works in a gradually mode. If there's a suddenly, those happen naturally. That coalesces naturally out of the system. That isn't something that occurs by fiat. None of those biologic suddenlies are because someone poked their finger in, you know, to something. Right? That's just a phase change in the system. Right. So the prince's staff have to avoid even the tiniest little bit of impatience. They have to be infinitely patient They have to think as gradually as possible. Right? Not get ahead of the Supreme. They've got to stay synchronized with this, the glacial pace of the Supreme. Right? They've got to think in terms of hundreds of thousands of years. Doesn't matter if they go, well, you know, if I was just, you know, given the leeway, we could put this together in 5 years. It's like, no, you need to take 500,000 years to do it. Just like the life carriers, you know, have to take hundreds of millions of years to do their job instead of a few million like they could do it. The Supreme isn't moving at the million-year pace. It's moving at the hundreds of millions of year pace, and you must stay precisely with the pace of the Supreme. If you get one step ahead of it, you're in rebellion. You know, that's the challenge. Can you pull back on the reins of your impatient spiritual consciousness enough to stay with the Supreme?
Why does the Carboniferous age have to last hundreds of millions of years? Maybe we are going to need those resources for a much longer period of time because we're so retarded than another planet where we'd go through this quickly.
Yeah. And why didn't the Revelators call them and break it into the two of Mississippian and Pennsylvanian? Why did they use the collective Carboniferous? Because that's the truth of that age. That's the carbon-bearing age. That's where you're storing up the carbon that you're going to need for the industrial, you know, times in the future. You know, coincidentally, carbon was stored up. Okay. So that's that's the biggie there. Just to notice that, if there's any doubt about them being civilizational uplifters. And then just noticing that they stress that whole bit again. It's like, why did they repeat that about you bring them in and send them out? Right? Because that's something that's true.
Period.
You know? I mean, there's a great truth there that transcends a lot of the details. Right? The United States, you know, like Abraham Lincoln knew in the Gettysburg Address, is this little light shining in the darkness. Right? How does that light affect the darkness? Not by letting the darkness come in en masse. Right? You need to do it just like Adam and Eve did it, just like the prince's staff did it. Right? Bring in those who are civilizable, enlighten them, uplift them, and send them out. You've got to think that way. It's like, well, yeah, that seems like I'm putting myself above them. Well, not in the eyes of the Father, you're not. This is not about spiritual idealism. This is about material pragmatism. Right? You know? And someone who can send spaceships to the planets is a little bit more advanced than someone who is still rubbing sticks to get a fire started. That's just the facts.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, what else we got here?
On your ranch, are these plans for planetary progress and cultural advancement were well underway, proceeding most satisfactorily, when the whole enterprise was brought to a rather sudden and most inglorious end by Caligastia's adherence to the Lucifer Rebellion.
So all of that, there's one word that you should notice there. It's in contrast to a word we just read here. Instead of gradually, it's
sudden.
There's the rebellion. Right? The difference between those two words. Right? So every time your spiritual consciousness says, you know, I want something now, I want it suddenly, right? You're unwittingly getting sucked into the rebellion.
Yeah, I gotta find that bathroom.
I don't know. Right? When the suddenly involves spirit, when it involves unity, right? That's the key, right? You know, you can build a fence suddenly. That's okay, okay? You can do it in a week instead of 5 years. That's okay, right? But when you think I want to just get unity in place tomorrow, I Unity shouldn't wait for the evolutionary process. Unity should be now. When, you know, what do we want? Greater unity. When do we want it? Now. Right, is the chant. That's the rebellion. That's what Lucifer said. That's what Caligastia said. That's what we still say. Now, humans didn't say that very much until just recently because we weren't spiritual enough to say that. I mean, all humans before we got the spiritual uplift, most humans, all they could think of is, what do I want? A better fence, right? When do I want it now? Okay, and that's fine. You can build a fence really fast. That's okay. Right? But when you start wanting an idyllic world and not just a more pragmatic fence, that's when there's a potential for problems. That's what's producing the emergency. Just like the civilizational emergency that ensued suddenly 200,000 years ago. See, because they're civilizational uplifters, they had a civilizational emergency 200,000 years ago. Amongst that core group, it all was brought to a head in 7 years. Right? Or on Gerasim in 2 years. But for the most of mankind, who were so primitive 200,000 years ago, it took us until now to get sophisticated enough in terms of our mindful selves that we could have the decision in front of us that they had 200,000 years ago. Which way, how are you going to relate to spirit? Impatiently or patiently? Self-righteously or humbly? Right? Do you think you're in charge of spirit energy or the Supreme? Who's the boss? Who knows the better way to get this planet to light and life? You or the Supreme? Caligastia thought he did. It worked out ingloriously, it says. the orgy of darkness and death, as we know. Yep.
It was one of the most profoundly shocking episodes. It was one of the most profoundly shocking episodes of this rebellion for me to learn of the callous perfidy of one of my own order of sonship, Caligastia, who, in deliberation and with malice aforethought, systematically perverted the instruction and poisoned the teaching provided in all the Urantia planetary schools in operation at that time. The wreck of these schools was speedy and complete.
Right. So, see, you know, notice, you know, he's in full sin mode. You know, malice aforethought. Yeah. Right? This isn't just evil. Right? This is sin. Right. And knowing that this would disrupt, doing it anyway. Okay, and it's like, why did they throw in that sort of uncommon word? I don't often hear the word perfidy thrown around in common parlance. Why would they use perfidy? Right? Why wouldn't they just say betrayal of trust? Why wouldn't they just say callous betrayal of trust? Kind of basically what it means. Why would they use the word? Well, what does it mean literally? Per, the prefix means through, and the root means faith. Through faith. Right? Oh, yeah. It is a test of faith. Right? They set you up, and now they're playing off of it. Right? Like I was saying, the prince's staff are manifesting that personal expression of Caligastia very definitively, so much so that you can work through it and get a hold of, recognize him personally through them, for good or for ill. Right? And that's why they use that. Through that faith conduit, they were deceived. So it's, you know, it's a much greater problem, right? I mean, if it was, you know, subpersonal, right, this corruption, it wouldn't have been so catastrophic. But no, you took that initial personal nature that you'd over 300,000 years had built up in these people, and you used that as the means to completely twist them around with malice aforethought. Right? And remember, there's no more cataclysmic thing to your personal quality than, you know, that betrayal of trust like that. I mean, like they say, I mean, Caligastia, I mean, his whole personal nature just collapses at that point and becomes just utterly perverted. You know, again, the word, the P-E-R prefix there, I mean, turned all the way through 180 degrees, right, to be perverted. Proceeding most satisfactorily, a wonderful creativity mode, to 180 degrees and full-on destructivity. And that's, they wanted you to, you know, they wanted to use that word so that you could get the fullness of what they're talking about. They were corrupted through faith. Yeah, the most horrendous thing that you could do. You know, that betrayal of trust like that. Yeah, did you have some?
Yeah, I was just wondering when you said a second ago, you know, do you think Lucifer, they did it because they wanted to destroy everything, or do you think they were doing it because they wanted to circumvent the way it was supposed to be and do it their way? They tried to make everything go so fast, and it didn't take very long before it all fell apart because mm-hmm. people weren't ready for it.
I know what you're asking. For those of you in the webinar, he's asking, it's like, you know, why did they want to do this? You know, why would they want to disrupt this? And that's the next section. We'll get to that next time. Really thinking about more precisely what exactly was motivating Lucifer, Satan, Caligastia, Caligastia, all these individuals. What was driving them to this? You know they weren't seeking the orgy of darkness and death. Now that's the caricature that we always paint, but the revelators are trying to teach us, no, it's very different than your caricatures of, you know, what the devil, you know, what motivates the devil. He's not motivated by the orgy of darkness and death. He's motivated by something very seductive. And we'll see that in the next section. So just hold on to that for next time. And that's the whole point of the next section, is for us to finally understand what was going on with them. Why would they do what they did?
That kind of stands in contrast to how he just expressed how he sees this.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, yeah, when all is said and done, it's a horrendous betrayal of trust. Think about these. You know, these are, you know, barely civilized. These are little children, right? It's just like Lucifer and Satan going to the, you know, planetary nursery, right? That's why it's callous perfidy, right? I mean, these faint little flickers of faith, and you're going to use that very faith to destroy them? How horrendous is that?
Well, right? And long-lasting. Because I'm trying to remember, I don't remember the details, but in some way Jesus reversed this lost trust for us. I can't think of anything worse than to have a father mm-hmm. that you implicitly trust
right.
betray you.
Right.
I mean, that would scar you.
Right, right.
Almost beyond
right repair. Yeah. Yes,
and somehow for the planet Jesus turned this around where we can trust again.
Right. I mean, the basic reason why you can so definitively overcome that is now there's nothing standing between you and what you need. I just think about what they're describing. These people need what the planetary prince has to offer, but they can't get it directly. They have to get it through the prince's staff. You have these intermediaries, right? The whole point of the universal bestowal of thought adjusters and pouring out the spirit of truth upon all flesh right, is so that no individual has to depend on any other individual. You can stand as a pure individual courageously and independently, right, in relationship to the cosmos. You don't have to depend on anything now. All of the doors are open, and all of the catalysts that to propel you across that threshold of that open door is there. You have everything you need to eliminate the isolation that's been imposed upon us. But again, you know, it's sad to record that so few persons on your ranch take delight in cultivating, overcoming what was done to us 200,000 years ago. You know, and then doubled down on, you know, 40,000 years ago. You know, in a number of ways. It's very sad that we have everything we need to overcome the darkness that we dwell in, and we take advantage of it not. All right, anyway, perfidy, see, through faith. To deceive through faith, to use the personal lever, you know, to not just twist a part, but to twist the whole.
Many of the offspring of the ascenders of the prince's materialized staff remained loyal, deserting the ranks of Caligastia. These loyalists were encouraged by the Melchizedek receivers of Urantia, and in later times their descendants did much to uphold the planetary concepts of truth and righteousness. The work of these loyal evangels helped to prevent the total obliteration of spiritual truth on Urantia. These courageous souls and their descendants kept alive some knowledge of the Father's rule and preserved for the world races the concept of the successive planetary dispensations of the various orders of divine sons.
The courageous souls, courageous and independent cosmic thinking, the spiritual truth, right? The total obliteration of spiritual truth on Urantia, what does that mean? Is that something in the external world they're talking about? No. Where is truth? In the upper domain of the hourglass, right? There remained a few souls on the planet that still had some relationship to the upper domain, the hourglass analogy of their mind, some relationship to truth, and hence to the cosmos. Again, remember, there's all those details about, the Nodites and the Amidonites and together as the Vanites. You know, the Northern Nodites and the Amidonites together, collectively called the Vanites, they're reminding you of that Nodite element. None of the initial rebel staff turned around, but, you know, they procreated, and some of those descendants recognized that they were in the wrong camp and headed north to Van and Amidon, right? That's who they're referring to here. They remained loyal, makes it sound like, maybe we're talking about the staff that remained loyal, but we're talking about not loyalty to, something on high, in an individual sense, loyalty to Michael or, loyalty to, whatever. Loyalty to the cosmos. And like I was just pointing out, they remained integrous, that loyal tadpole. And that's what they're referring to there. You've got this, there are no iniquitous six-year-olds. We're all born innocent. Even if you're the descendants of the rebellious staff, right? You're born innocent. You're born loyal. That initial encirclement in the Holy Spirit is a thread of loyalty to the cosmos. Mm-hmm. You're born loyal, right? And it's just a matter of whether you remain that way or you choose to use your powers of choice to destroy that thread of loyalty to the cosmos. Right? Or if you remain, in its grace. All right. So like I said, next time, you know, this is a very, very important section in the book, this next section that we'll get to. You know, you should commit the developmental epics to memory so you can begin to think in them. There's many, many things you can't understand about the world you live in or the history of this planet if you aren't intuitively intimate with this the pattern of this sequence. So we'll get into that next time. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.